ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with producer and director Allison Argo. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
According to the wildlifenews.com, when we look at the biggest use of water in the western United States, livestock, meaning cattle, stands alone. All the water users are trying to conserve this valuable resource. And very controversial efforts are being explored to expand the supply of water by drilling deeper and pumping aquifers even harder to make an end to the drought. Part of the problem of allocating this fading vital resource is the perception of who uses the most water. We commonly hear people complain about the waste of maintaining bluegrass lawns in an arid region. There are similar complaints about ornamental fountains, water parks, car washes, swimming pools, and the like. All this, however, pales when compared to agriculture. There are many ways to present water use figures, but in general, California ag takes about four times as much water as urban areas. California grows many high-value crops such as almonds, onions, strawberries, lettuce, cotton, beans, and tomatoes. Few states grow so many high-value crops, but nonetheless, the biggest agricultural user in California is, directly and indirectly, livestock. California produces a diversity of livestock, but the majority is cattle. The Golden State, however, gives us a misleading picture of the amount of water consumed by cattle because California has such a diverse economy. If we look at other western states, cattle as the dominant water user truly soars to the top of the use list. Unfortunately, beef is a very inefficient way to make protein. So if you want to conserve water, skip the meat and eat healthy veggies.
Most people don't want to see how sausage is made. They prefer not to know what's in their ham, bacon, and Spam. Allow me a moment to lift the veil. The USDA is piloting a new pork inspection program that features sped-up lines and a reduction in government inspectors. And USDA inspectors are now speaking out publicly in condemnation of it. The Government Accountability Project recently released affidavits from USDA inspectors working in plants running the pilot program, which is known as Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Points, HACCP, or as the inspectors refer to it, have a cup of coffee and pray. In the five plants currently using the pilot system, line speeds are faster, and fewer USDA inspectors are on the job, and now the USDA is looking to expand the program to even more factories. The government inspectors allege that the pilot program gives too much regulatory control to the industry. The new model replaces USDA line inspectors with plant employees, who they say lack both the adequate training to spot defects and signs of contamination, and the legal safeguards that would allow them to freely speak out about food safety problems. The company threatens plant employees with terminations if they see them condemning too many carcasses. In one affidavit from a man who retired last year after 23 years as a meat inspector, he noted that inspectors aren't stopping to remove defects, meaning meat contaminated with hair, tumors, toenails, and feces is getting shipped out to consumers. Another inspector wrote, "It seems like the USDA is doing all it can to make sure the program succeeds in this plant, even if it means betraying consumers by hiding the truth about their food." Another inspector wrote, "Personally, I will not eat any products that bear the name of the company for which this meat is produced. I don't think that it's safe to consume." Another meat inspector wrote in his affidavit, "It's not whether or not people are going to eat shit. They are. It's just how much." Think about it. Do you really like bacon that much?
There's great news for a bear named Ricky. After spending 16 miserable years in an undersized chain link and concrete cage at a Pennsylvania ice cream shop, Ricky is now residing at the Wild Animal Sanctuary in Colorado. Her release comes as part of a settlement reached between the Animal Legal Defense Fund and Ricky's former owner. In December 2014, ALDF filed a lawsuit on behalf of concerned Pennsylvania residents against Jim Mack's Ice Cream for displaying a female black bear named Ricky in inhumane and dangerous conditions. The lawsuit accused Ricky's owner of violating state regulations that require humane care for wild animals. For years, Ricky lived in a pathetically small cage without any enrichment and was fed dried dog food by visitors. Veterinarians confirmed that Ricky suffered high levels of stress and anxiety on top of an inadequate diet and substandard housing. Bears require large, environmentally complex spaces in which to engage in their typical movements, such as bathing, exploring, climbing, and denning. And that's what she's going to get at the Wild Animal Sanctuary in Colorado. At the sanctuary, Ricky will now have 15 acres of space to roam. After her acclimation, Ricky will be able to run free and play with other bears, something she's never before been able to do, and splash in natural lakes and ponds. The public complained about Ricky's former situation at the ice cream shop for more than a decade. In fact, petitions with nearly 200,000 signatures in total had voiced public clamor for Ricky's release. You can watch a touching video of Ricky's rescue at ALDF.org. Stay with us. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Allison Argo. Allison has directed, written, and narrated 18 films for National Geographic and PBS, including Keepers of the Wild, The Last Frog, The Secret Life of Cats, and Parrot Confidential. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Allison Argo. Thanks for being with us, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Allison, can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues?
Well, I have often say that I was kidnapped by gorillas. I grew up in the theater and was pursuing a fairly successful acting career, and I'd go on location and would visit zoos and always would visit the gorillas because I'd become really interested in them following Diane Fossey's work in the wild, and I just was just smitten with what incredible creatures these were. And it was actually when I went to a tacky shopping mall in Tacoma, Washington, and met Ivan, a solitary silverback gorilla who had been living alone, hadn't seen another gorilla for almost 30 years, and had been living in basically a concrete concrete-walled enclosure, hadn't been outside in almost 30 years.
Jeez.
I was just, very inspired to bring this story and the plight of gorillas living in captivity to the public because we knew too much at that point. We knew what made gorillas tick. We knew how they lived in the wild, what they needed, that they're extremely social animals. And we just knew too much to be treating a gorilla like Ivan the way that he was being treated. So that was my first film, and I didn't know anything about making a film. And it took me about 3 years and trial and error, and finally National Geographic caught wind of my film and asked if they could see it, and they ended up airing it, and I continued on with Geographic funding my various film ideas.
So I guess it was probably a hard transition moving from, well, it doesn't seem like it's a hard transition actually, moving from on the stage to behind the camera, because you have more than 18 films now.
Yeah, oddly enough, it couldn't have been easier. I never looked back. I do not miss performing at all. Although I do narrate my own films, and so I can draw on that past experience. But I'm so grateful to be making documentaries and be able to look at the issues, pressing issues around us, and to be able to say, like the parrot issue. Who knew that there were so many parrots that were being mistreated or needed homes, and more being brought into the world by breeders, and also poaching is continuing. So it's fantastic to be able to look at an issue and say, I need to bring this to the world so that people can make intelligent, informed choices in their lives.
And so you made the film Parrot Confidential last year, and it won a Humane Society award and other awards. You've got so many awards under your belt. Congratulations.
Thank you. I always feel like it's just so random. I always know, you know, if you want an award, you're not going to win it. So it's usually best to keep your nose to the ground and do the best work that you can to please yourself. And if you get an award, that's a wonderful bonus, and it always is a nice gust of wind in your sails to get out there and push again for the next thing. But it really is about having my own standards and just trying to outdo myself each time.
Right. So why did you make Parrot Confidential?
Well, I have a sister who many years ago, I guess it was probably 20 years ago, bought a parrot, and it was an Amazon, and she bought it for her husband as a gift, and it was a disaster. This poor parrot, I still remember his name was Rico. The parrot hated her husband. The husband hated the parrot. It was disastrous for the bird. It was disastrous for the family. And the bird ended up, you know, they immediately, or after trying for, I guess, 4 years, they finally found somebody to take this bird. And I've always felt really just sick about that. It just seems so unfair to this poor bird that's, you know, a flighted creature in a cage, for starters, is so incapacitated, has no power. They can't speak to us. I mean, they can mimic us, but to me, that's just the ultimate victim, you know. And so I always felt just dark about that. And then I happened to bump into some people who told me about this growing problem. And sometimes I bring blankets and, you know, old towels to my local animal rescue, which is around the corner. And one time I went in recently, and there was a parrot. And it had been relinquished, and they didn't know what to do with it. They don't specialize in parrots. And I began to realize the enormity of the problem. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, I'm pretty on top of things, but even I didn't know about this growing problem. And I thought, if I don't know about it, there must be a whole lot of people who don't know about it. And so I set out to make the film just to let people know what's going on and let people know before they go in and unwittingly buy a bird like Rico. Do your homework and know that these birds don't generally fit into a human world very well. And if we can diminish the demand, hopefully we can diminish the supply. One of the saddest things to me is that here we have this overwhelming population of unwanted birds in the Western world, and a third of all parrots are endangered in the wild.
Yeah.
So it's a paradox that's very sad.
Yeah, I agree. I personally have a conure myself that a student, you know, wanted to get rid of here on the campus, and of course they didn't know what to do with the bird, and they hadn't taken care of it, and the one of the feet had been pinched off by a band, you know, how they band the birds, and I've had Sunny now for 12 years, and I just feel guilty. The same thing every time I look at him in his cage. I'm like, this is so unfair that he has to live his life in this small cage. I mean, we do what we can to make it better, but, you know, it is a tragic existence for many of these birds.
That's so true. And another message that I hope comes through loud and clear in the film is, if you feel, I mean, it's just wonderful that you were able to take Sonny in and can actually provide him with a decent, well, as good a life as you can under the circumstances. But if, you know, if a viewer feels that he or she is up to the task and really can be there for the bird and give the bird everything it needs, then adopt. Do not go out to a pet shop.
Oh, of course.
And it's funny because so much of the public understands that with dogs and cats. I mean, finally, I think, you know, we've gotten to the point where the average person knows that the right thing to do is to go to your shelter and adopt one of the unwanted cats and dogs. But the message has not gotten out there about birds.
I know. Well, all you have to do is go on one of these pet, like petfinder.com or something, and if you type in parrot, like 20,000 will pop up, you know, that all need homes. So it is a huge problem. And we live here near the border, and of course, people from Mexico, I think Mexico is a big supplier of parrots to the pet trade, and it's really unfortunate, like you said.
It still is, yeah. Poaching is still alive and well, unfortunately. It's really big business. I received an email from a woman just the other day who lives in Florida, and she's really concerned about there, you know, is a growing wild, I guess, feral population, you know, maybe birds, captive birds, have gotten free and they've bred. And so there's a very large population. And poaching is a huge problem. These birds are being snatched from nests and sold at flea markets, and they've got broken wings and broken legs. And, you know, it's a bad situation.
Yeah, I was recently in West Palm Beach, and every morning when I was walking over to my convention center, I saw a big flock of feral parrots fly overhead. And here in El Paso, we even actually have a population of feral parrots down in the upper and lower valley where I live. So every morning we have feral parrots outside screaming around, flying around. They do look nice, but, you know, people don't realize that they're really not adapted for this climate.
But it's so magnificent to see them in the wild with their flock, because that's what we take from them. I mean, we take their flight away, and we also take their companionship, which is they're very, very social beings, and some of them even mate for life. And to deny that, I think it's hard to live with that rationale.
And you know what I think is interesting is, you know, they say their intelligence and emotional complexity, you know, approaches that of chimpanzees and dolphins. But, you know, people don't turn around and, you know, they don't say, hey, I have a big pool in my backyard. I'm going to try and get, you know, I'm going to try and make it for a dolphin or try and get a chimpanzee. I mean, although people do it, but it's so much more common for parrots. And, you know, they're really not accustomed to a life of captivity. You know, they talk about cats and dogs and the thousands of years of domestication, and it hasn't really been that time frame for parrots.
No, not at all. I think, you know, at the most, maybe you could find a parrot that's three generations from wild, normally more like two, if that. So, yeah, that's not the thousands of years of the domestication process. And dogs and cats have been bred for certain qualities that make them good companions. And, you know, parrots have not gone through that process. You're right.
And a lot of times they display a lot of very aberrant behavior because of their situation of being confined and being taken out of their social structure. If you try to force a social structure on them, they'll pull each other's feathers out and do all
pull
kinds.
Their own.
Pull their own feathers out of stress. It's very, very stressful situation for these birds.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I try to do what I can to, you know, when I bump up against people who might not know about the situation for birds, both in the wild, because I go to Costa Rica fairly often, and people say, I mean, poaching happens all the time. Yeah. And usually the people realize after a year, I really don't want this bird. And so,
right. And then by sure numbers game, I mean, some can live, what, to 80
years
plus? Yeah. Yeah, so if you think about, you know, if we euthanize more than 3 to 4 million dogs and cats each year, and you think about dogs generally living 15, 20 years max, I mean, this is really going to be an epidemic if people don't start taking this seriously.
Yeah. In places like Costa Rica, the people really don't know also how to properly care for the birds physically, and so they're in very small cages, which is extremely stressful. I mean, tiny cages, and they're not fed good diets, and so they generally don't live very long. And so, you know, your parrot dies, and you go buy another one from a poacher. And so, it's the wild is really quickly being drained because the birds are not living for their normal lifespans at all. They'll live briefly and then pass away from poor care. So, it's a bad cycle.
And the U.S. helped ban, you know, the import of most wild-caught parrots in, I think, in the 90s, right?
So we have the Bird Act, the Wild Bird Act.
And where's the other influx of birds coming from? I mean, I know you mentioned capture, but I'm sure there's a significant amount of breeding going on.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of the private breeders have when they realized that there was a growing problem with unwanted birds, they stopped breeding. But there are still factory breeding farms in, you know, the warmer climates. They're still pumping out birds, and there still is poaching. There still are birds coming in from the wild. And there's a big problem with African greys. They're being drained from the wild. It is still big business. And it would be great if we could, if the demand went down enough that these larger breeding operations just didn't find it viable anymore to pump out birds. That would be great.
Allison, we're interested in what you're working on next. Can you tell us about a project in the works?
I would love to. It's a really different project, but I think a super important one and a very intriguing one. I stumbled on a story about a pig farmer, and I'm happy to say that he's a humane pig farmer, that he has provided for 10 years an almost idyllic life for the pigs that he raises. He usually has about 250 pigs on the farm, and he takes them to a humane slaughterhouse. And one day he was with the pigs, about a year ago, he was with the pigs, and just he realized that he'd learned to respect them to the point that he just didn't want to be in the business of death anymore. He did not want to be taking them to the slaughterhouse any longer. And so it's the story of his transition out of pig farming, which has not been an easy one. I mean, he's grappled with his guilt. All of his money is tied up in this pig farm, the 250 pigs, the equipment, all that. So when he decided that he no longer wanted to be part of this, he couldn't just say, okay, game over. He had to see it through while he tried to find a place to send as many of the pigs as he could. He found sanctuary for 8 of them, but the rest of it, he had to just see it through, and it was a soul-crushing experience. The guy is incredibly articulate and a beautiful writer, so we followed him. He allowed us to follow him through his transition for the last year. We've been there through all the seasons as he's grappled with his conscience and, you know, had to live with what he set in motion 10 years ago. It's going to be a very powerful film, I think. I think one of the most powerful parts of it is that it's not that he was a factory farmer. It wasn't about gestation crates. I mean, he was providing a beautiful life for these pigs for as long as they lived. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't feel that humane and farming could really work in the same sentence.
Yeah, it seems when you're producing or you're using animals as a production item or as a commodity, it makes it very hard to have any kind of humane aspect to it, because in the end they usually have to die, you know. And right. Like mm-hmm. you said, even humane slaughter, the end is they're being slaughtered for people to consume as a product. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm hoping the film is not, you know, a typical advocacy film. The film is really a very intimate journey into somebody's life as they go through a transition, and this man conjures up the courage to change his life, turn his life upside down, inside out. He's going to try to become a vegetable farmer.
Oh, good.
but he knows nothing about it. He's going to learn. And he knows that most farm startups fail within the first year. So, I mean, he's terrified to make this change, and yet he's got to for his own soul. And so I hope that the film will invite an uninitiated audience, you know, nobody who's, it doesn't say that you should become a vegetarian or vegan. He happens to have become a vegetarian himself, but I'm hoping that we can reach a new audience that will just at least think about where their food comes from, and in an unthreatening way, in a non-threatening way, that, you know, when they go to get that package of chicken out of the freezer at the grocery store, or the even the grain-fed beef that they think.
Right. Or
I think a lot of us just desensitize ourselves.
Yeah, and everybody's running around wearing shirts that say, I love bacon on it, you know.
Right.
it helps the desensitization process. So it's really great that he was willing to come forward and share his story. And, you know, like you said, that he was able to find sanctuary for only 8 of the pigs, because when you think about it, pigs are huge animals. And I think a lot of people have become so disconnected with animals that they forget that a pig is like a, what, 600-pound animal. It's not that easy to place.
Right, yeah.
If you need to place 200 pigs, it's going to be difficult. I mean, they have a lot of needs. They have to have room and food and veterinary care. I mean, that's a huge undertaking to try to place those animals.
That's absolutely right. And they're going to grow to 600 pounds. They'll be around for 20 years. They need space. They need companionship. They need mud wallows and, yes, food, veterinary care. I worry that, you know, there was a whole problem with pot-bellied pigs.
Oh, yes,
And now, you know, we have these, quote-unquote, mini pigs, right? And that's become a trendy pet to get. And I've read a few stories where these pigs don't end up really to be miniature. And
right.
And so I think that might be the next pet that's going to be dumped, you know.
Quickly, too, speaking of transitioning to more of a plant-based diet, you have an interesting story about your transition, is that right?
Yes, yes. Well, I haven't eaten most meat for almost 30 years. I just stopped. I care not only about animal welfare, but I really care deeply about the welfare of the planet. I really want there still to be wild places left and rainforests and diversity. And so for that reason, as well as the welfare of animals, I stopped eating meat. But I did eat chicken occasionally, and I don't know how I rationalized it, but I was making a film called The Urban Elephant, and I was following, it's about the plight of elephants in captivity, and I was following a circus elephant for a few days, and they would go from, you know, location to location overnight. Every day would be a new, you know, with circuses, it's a new venue every day, and the big top goes up, or every 2 days. The big top goes up, the elephants help put it up, and then the elephants help take it down. So they packed up, and we met them at the next location early in the morning, and it was near Bakersfield somewhere in California. And it was just an empty lot, sort of a dusty, you know, just dirt empty lot. And they were unloading the elephants, and the elephants were, you know, they walk out backwards out of the trailer. And suddenly the two elephants became so agitated, they just started roaring and trumpeting and hurling their trunks on the ground and, you know, roughing the sand up with their feet and just going around in circles and clearly really agitated. And I asked the, you know, the trainer what was going on, what was this behavior, and he said, the only thing I can think of is this used to be a chicken farm. It was, you know, a chicken farm and processing plant. And they were clearly sniffing the environs and were really, really upset. And I'd never seen anything like it. And that was when the corner, you know, I turned a corner and said, I can't rationalize eating chicken anymore. That's crazy. So it was really the elephants and their reaction to what lingered there in the dirt, in the earth, that
right.
I will never know, but
well, trust the elephants, I think, is
exactly,
the moral of the story.
Exactly. I can't make the films that I make and
right.
eat creatures.
Right. Well, speaking of, can you tell us where our listeners can go to learn more about your work?
Absolutely. Please visit my website. It's very simple. It's argofilms.com. Keep your eyes peeled for The Last Pig. I think it's going to be a really significant film. So.
We've been talking with Allison Argo. Thanks for being with us, Allison.
Thank you so much.
If you'd like to learn about a vegetarian diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. There you will also learn about our many upcoming events.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button.
And of course, don't forget to visit Allison's website at argofilms.com.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.